The following show is dedicated to Mia Park and Barbara Yang. The views expressed on the following show may not be those of the hosts, guests, or WSPN Skidmore Radio. Talk Saratoga is produced by Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated and may not be reproduced in part or in whole unless expressed written approval is given. Now, here are the hosts of Talk Saratoga, Rick Thompson and a Saratoga All-Star.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Saratoga. I'm your host, Rick Thompson. And we always have on our pre-recorded opening, they introduce me as host and a Saratoga All-Star. And I've got not only a Saratoga All-Star, but a world All-Star. And I want to introduce Ramon because he won't say a lot of this himself. He's a great guy. He doesn't like talking about himself. But he began riding horses at the age of 16 in his native Venezuela. And in 2001, he got his big break by becoming the winningest jockey in the United States. He repeated the feat in 2003 and in 2004 and won the Isaac Murphy Award for having the highest winning percentage among all American-based jockeys. He was a regular rider, a two-time Eclipse Award-winning turf champion, Gio Ponti, and he rode that horse to six victories, grade one stake races, which is an awesome feat in itself. He won three Breeder Cup rides, and his third one was the final win in 2012. He won six races in one day on four occasions, and the most recent one before he retired was July 22nd of 2012. He rode six winners from seven horses that he was riding that day at Saratoga, and he tied the same day win record by a jockey among all New York tracks. He's the second jockey in Saratoga history to win six races on a single card. He also won five races in one day on several occasions, and he ended up in his career with mounts earning $25,582,000, and he had 4,985 wins in his career that was cut short by an injury. So I want to introduce Ramon Dominguez. Ramon, it's great having you on the show, and it's great seeing you again. Usually I see you in Walmart parking lot waiting for Sharon to come out from grocery shopping.
Oh, she's going to kill you. Morning, Rick.
I know she is. How, you had such a great career, and I was at the track the year that you were elected into the Hall of Fame. I think it was 2016. And, I didn't know you then, but you became an instant friend because you are so, I don't know what the word is, but you're so great around people. You're just happy all the time. You love to talk to people. And I'll never forget, I said, hey, congratulations. And he spent about a minute talking to me, and we didn't even know each other. And you're just a great guy.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, I'll always say that when I get any type of compliment like this, which means so much to me, but it's entirely a reflection of my parents. I come from the most wonderful family who are always looking to help others. So I feel great, and really when it comes to horse racing, it is such a huge community that becomes like family. So I have done it all in the sport. I groom horses before I rode horses for a while. I exercised them before I became a jockey. So I can relate to a lot of these workers and a lot of the people, and even among the owners, I mean, a lot of them have become great friends. So coming to the track is a wonderful time for me because I get to see old friends and meet a lot of new friends. So we are all held together by one common thread, which is the love for these horses.
That's right. Well, I've been at the track in the summer, doing security for, I think it's like 14 years now. And even that job, you do become family, not only with the other security guards downstate, but with the jockeys that come up. You know where I am. I'm in the clubhouse right up from the winner's circle. I guard the press box stairs. And so a lot of owners and trainers and jockeys come up, you know, and you get to know them, and it's almost like a family reunion every year. So you do, and one of I tell you, the racing industry is one of the close-knit families of any industry that I've ever been associated with or heard about. I mean, you all are dedicated so much to not only the racing end of it, but taking care of the horses after and the programs associated with it. I know Sharon just got promoted to, you know, a really good position and a volunteer position. And it's once you're involved in that, you just can't, it doesn't get out of your blood.
So true, yes. And I think in many cases, not only the love that we have for the sport, but also, like in my case, is just you have sort of like a moral responsibility to continue to help and support the industry. And by that, I mean even when it comes to supporting the permanently disabled jockeys or aftercare for the race horses. So that's something that comes pretty naturally. It doesn't require a big effort at all because it's just something that you grew up in that environment and you know how important these organizations are.
Yeah. And you give up a lot of your personal life to be involved in racing and aftercare and chaplaincy, you know, after your career's over. So how did you get into horse racing?
Well, my dad, when I was really young, took me to the racetrack because at the time he had a job outside racing, or one of the jobs he had is back in the days in Venezuela where I grew up, people will bear like a pick six. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the day, he had to take these papers where people will make their selection to the racetrack. And I went to the racetrack with him and watched live a race. And I just knew right then and there, Rick, that was a career that I wanted to pursue. I knew that I wanted to become a jockey, and that became an obsession for me.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic. Hey, you remember Luis Granderson, right?
Yes, sure.
Yeah,
he was
a great announcer, and he was upstairs every time he came down. He was dressed, you know, in a suit and tie, and I think he's back calling races with Naira, if I'm not mistaken. I thought I read that somewhere,
I
know he was calling in Venezuela for a while.
I think Panama is where he's
Panama?
From. Yeah, Panama, yeah.
Oh, okay. So you were really young, and that's when you decided that's what you wanted to do. So like you said, you started out grooming and hot walking, and was that just to be around the horses and get...
So, well, when I decided to become a jockey to pursue the career, I had to go back home to a really remote racetrack, very rural, and slept in the tack room, and as part of the education, you had to take care of a few horses. So I was assigned 3 horses, so I took care of them, fed them, took all of the manure out, and walked them, and did everything for the horses.
Gave them a bath.
Yes, you gave them a bath, yes. And then eventually you start exercising one or two of them. And so that's all part of the learning process. And although taking care of the horse, you never really have to do that when you become a jockey. Still, all of those basic experiences and knowledge that you're acquiring are so, so important because it really makes you a much better horseman overall. Mm-hmm. You're able to connect with the horse better. You can understand their behavior. So all of that becomes something important in the overall picture.
Now, you never wanted to become... I know some of the jockeys, after they retire, become trainers or...
Or agents.
Or agents, yeah. Right, agents. You never wanted to get involved in that end of it?
I never did, no. I mean, I know that it is a very demanding job, both of them, being a horse trainer, because you have to be 24/7 on top of your barn, the horses, and also managing the political aspect of dealing with the owners. So that can be difficult sometimes. So I really was not interested at all in becoming a trainer, and being an agent is great at the same time. Really, for many reasons, it's not something that I was looking to
right.
do.
Right. Like you said, there's probably a lot of politics in it, and, you know, so, and
definitely.
You're looking out. If you have more than one jockey, you're looking out for the interest of all of them, and sometimes that's tough, too, you know.
True.
I just don't want to get into it too much, but you're a great jockey. I consider you one of the best jockeys ever. And, I mean, I knew Angel and Lafitte, but you're one of my heroes in racing. You really are. But you were young when your injury happened and your career was cut short.
Yes, I was 36 years old when I got hurt. And, I had come from my best year yet. I ended up leader in the nation. I broke that year the most money being earned by a jockey. And then the following year, in January 2013, I was involved in a racing accident while riding a race, and I fell and I had multiple skull fractures and a traumatic brain injury. And my recovery was took some time as expected, and I was excited, looking forward to come back. And then all of my doctors set me down and say, you cannot afford to hit your head again. You cannot be out there. This was my second skull fracture while riding, and I had quite a few concussions, so they knew my risk was way too high, and so that sort of made the decision for me not to continue.
Right, and I'm sure Sharon had something to do with it, too.
She was happy. I mean, she felt the same I did. I'm happy, and we're blessed that I'm doing well.
Yeah.
At the same time, and it was difficult to separate from the sport, especially when I was doing so well. But she knew that it was the right thing for me as a person, for my well-being, but also in the future. Yeah.
Of your life, I mean, basically. And I know it had to be crushing for you because, you know, I see Rich McGlorio a lot, and he had to stop riding horses, although he still rides a little bit on his farm, which he isn't supposed to do, but because he had so many injuries, too. I don't think people really realize how... I think jockeys are probably some of the best athletes in the world because you're controlling a 2,000-pound animal underneath you, and you're maneuvering in between trying to get position in a race. And I don't think people realize what a job that is.
Yes, I mean, only the... You, as you were talking about how you... Controlling an animal that weighs 1,000 to 100 pounds, but also throughout the whole race, if we're talking specifically about the race, you have to be hyper aware of 1,000 things that are happening simultaneously, not only how you connect with your horse, how you get your horse to do what he's supposed to do, getting to relax the first part, saving the energy, and then when it's time to make a run, to be there for you, but also... You're surrounded by horses. You have horses in front, around you, behind. So any movement that you make or any change in direction slightly, because sometimes you want to position yourself a little better, you have to be aware that an inch movement lateral can make a difference or can really affect somebody else's horse. So all of that happens, again, in a fraction of a second. But it's something that, by repetition, by doing it over and over, it becomes second nature to you.
Uh-huh.
Many of the decisions that you have to make, honestly, you don't even have to make a conscious decision. It just comes naturally. You can sort of analyze the setting in front of you, sort of like a chess player that sometimes they just look at the pieces and they know what is the next best move.
Right.
And same way, the jockeys, when you're in that position, you kind of know, okay, this is what I need to do. So
right.
that's very interesting, and nonetheless, definitely continues to be a demanding job, not only physically, because you are balancing your whole body on your tippy toes. It's not like people think that you're sitting on the saddle, you're not. And but in addition to that, controlling this huge animal.
And you're not like big muscular guys or girls that, you know, can I know you got, you're strong. You work out and that, but you know it's not like you're 6 foot five like a football player.
Sure. Well, yes and no. Well, I tell you, definitely the height, we have to be typically short because the taller you are, the more weight that you're gonna carry with you,
right.
And you need to meet certain ways. But it's amazing because jockeys, when you look at these guys, they were full of muscles, defined muscles, and although they are not big muscles, because again the weight factor, when it comes to controlling a horse, most of the time you do this by finessing the horse, and it's just putting pressure in their mouth or releasing that pressure that kind of send them the signal. But there are times when these horses are just like a child that is throwing a temper tantrum. Yeah, they have their own mind, and they really want to get strong with you. And in those cases, it really requires for you to apply a lot of force in their mouth to control them. And it's incredible how strong us as jockeys are. It is amazing. Honestly, I don't know if there is a way to measure this strength that the jockeys have, but I will venture to say that we are as strong as any other athlete, pound for pound. Yes, I mean, it's probably similar to a wrestler.
Well, like I said, I think you're. I think jockeys are probably the top athletes because of what you have to do, just like you said. I mean, it's like a chess game. You have to anticipate your next move without interfering with another horse, and you have to control that. And people don't realize you're not sitting in the saddle. You're on your tippy toes and trying to do all this at the same time. I mean, you're awesome. You really are. And
Rick, I have to tell you what you said about being on your tippy toes. What comes to mind is when I had my last injury, my brain injury, my wife tells me, because I was completely out of it, that the doctors kept on coming out of the room where I was asking her if I exercise. And she was like, plain and simple, yes, he's a jockey. And then they'll come back and say, but yes, but does he exercise also? And then she, because my heart rate was in the low 40s, and they said, that's for somebody who is extremely fit. And so she said, sir, he's a professional jockey. So one of the doctors, she said that, say, man, we know that he sit on the horse, but does he also work out? And she's like, you don't get it. He's on his tippy toes. That's exactly what she said, balancing his whole body. And that's why he's so fit. So, yeah, I couldn't understand why my heart rate was so low if I was supposedly sitting on the horse.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, it's amazing, I tell you. So, and like I said, it had to have been hard for you to have to stop riding. I mean, like you said, you're at the top of your game and that. But, I mean, all for the best. I mean,
yeah.
If you didn't want to get in another injury. The I forget what race it was this year, past year, when Ortiz mm-hmm. ended up, that one pitcher, when he the horse threw him and he
with
was
my frame, yeah.
Yeah, and he was holding two horses. He was in between two horses.
Incredible, yeah.
That was incredible, and that had to be a scary moment.
Oh, super. I was actually at the track that day because it was a big day, and watching that, I was like, oh, my gosh, because God forbid, I mean, there were still horses behind him.
Oh, yeah.
But thankfully, he came out of it with just a few bruises. And, yes, a horse coming from the outside, going for position, going into this first turn, we want to save ground, knocked him off stride, and Ira lost his balance. And actually, the other jockey that was next to him also was on Guayra Barrio in a point, it looked like he was going to come off his horse, but Ira tried to do his best, kind of managing, as you said, putting his hand in both horses, but ultimately he came off the horse. So, yeah, that's definitely an example of how
strong.
They're strong and how dangerous the profession is, both.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that pitcher that Skip took, that became, I think
he won the Clips Award. Yeah,
yeah. That was an awesome pitcher. I have it on my phone because I show people. When I talk about how strong jockeys are and what they have to do, and they see that picture, they can't believe it. They said, that's awesome. And I said, well, it was a scary moment, I'll tell you that, because you didn't see it if you were watching the race, because it happens in a second. But when you see that picture, it's like, wow.
Yes.
You know, you can't. So let's talk a little bit about your career as a jockey, because you, like I said, you're kind of like my number one jockey, and you've had such an amazing history in racing.
Thank you. Yeah, I was really fortunate because I started riding in Venezuela as an apprentice my first year, and then right away, not only myself, but most of my peers or their apprentices over there, we idolize and we look up to American racing, and we'll watch some races or replays or even photos of these jockeys, how well they look on top of a horse. So from the beginning, that became a goal for me to come to the United States and ride here. But that wasn't an easy thing to do because the fact that most people wanted to migrate or most people wanted to come here made getting a visa very difficult. I was very fortunate when I made an appointment to go to the embassy, and it was a long story, but basically I was given the visa. And actually, I'm going to expand a little bit on that because I do believe in some of these synchronicities that we call, you know, luck or we call coincidence. But I go with my mom, who had previously come to the United States, and made the appointment to come with her. And that was a big plus because she had shown that she had multiple trips to the United States and came back to Venezuela. She didn't stay.
Oh, okay.
But as we are in the embassy, I was the first one in line, and she was right behind me, to go and get this interview with an American person to see why we were coming here. And the reality is that I was coming here again with the goal of pursuing a career as a jockey, but unfortunately you could not say that because I had to apply for a tourist visa. That's the only way. Yes, I mean, you can never apply for a work visa because you will be denied. In order for you to apply for a work visa, you had to get a sponsor first, and I didn't know anybody. So when I go in front of this lady, she asked me why I was coming to the United States, and I lied. I told the white lie that most people in Venezuela say, which is to come to Disney World. And right away, she asked me if I had a hotel reservation, which is kind of an odd question. Obviously, I haven't been granted a visa. So that's exactly what I said. Well, I'm waiting to get my visa accepted. And she had it in her mind that I wasn't going to get a visa, and perhaps she was able to tell that I wasn't really being truthful. She said, you know, the hotels, it's this high season, there will be no rooms available, which is not true. But just as she's telling me that, my mom had already gone to be interviewed by another guy, and the guy said to the lady, hey, so-and-so, they're together, send him over here. So she closed my passport, gave it to me, and I went over there, and he was just laughing, talking to my mom, and he said, yeah, sure, and he stamped my passport, and he gave me the visa.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I...
Glad your mom was with you.
Yes, thank God. And but the chances of that happening are really, really low at that time. I actually, even to get the passport, there was a crisis in Venezuela, and they didn't have enough materials or something, and they were not giving passports. At the time, they were giving a sheet of paper that was valid only for 4 months.
Oh,
nice. And the word got around in the jockey room in Venezuela that I wanted to come here, and a fellow jockey who also became an apprentice in the same promotion than me, John Rocha was his name. Wonderful, wonderful human being. Afterwards I came to the U.S. and he ended up dying from an injury while exercising a horse in the morning.
Oh, dear.
Awful. But he told me, Ramon, I know somebody in the organization and the place where they gave the passports. And he said, let's go. And we went to see this guy. And he was a fan of racing and jockeys. We went, I remember, to the third floor. And there was a big table with the passport, actual passports. And he gave me one. We went all the way to ground level, caught through the line. The lines was going outside the building. There was hundreds of people, and people were saying, they're cutting through the line. Went to the very to the front of the line, and the lady behind the window stamped my passport, and that's how I got the passport. So, yeah, crazy stuff. So, anyways, just to summarize how I came here, a friend from over there who had some connections in the United States spoke with an agent, and the guy accepted to take my book or to handle my business as a jockey, and I came to the United States and stayed with the guy for a couple months before I kind of opened my wings and started going my way. But yeah, and that's how I started riding in the United States in 1996.
Wow. See, you were young, so you cut in line. It didn't matter to you, you know. I mean, whatever people. But that's an amazing story. Now, I got a passport last October because I was supposed to go to China with my friend here. So I've got an empty passport sitting in my dresser. So if you ever need one, I don't know. That's amazing. I don't think people realize, you know, we have a thing here about illegal immigration and all of that, but I don't think people realize how much people want to get to the United States.
Yes, and I would say to finish that part about my legals or my status coming here. So I came with a tourist visa. Again, was welcomed by this agent that agreed to take my book or work with me. But right away, the following day, I went and spoke with an attorney that I was appointed to see this guy, an immigration attorney, introduced all of my papers, and it took 2.5 months that I was actually in the hotel doing nothing. I'll be going here and there, or maybe every so often go to the races in the afternoon to watch the races, but I could not get on a horse because I didn't have my visa yet. And after 2.5 months, I was granted a visa, P1 visa, which is a work visa. And then when that was granted, I had to go back home. And actually, I went to the same embassy. And what are the chances that out of 10, 12 people who were behind these windows, I happened to be right again in front of the guy who granted me the tourist visa?
Okay.
And he was disappointed. He said to me, "Why, my friend, I believe in you." And he never really explained why he was disappointed. It was clear. Basically, you lied to me. You said that you were going to be a tourist. And the reality, I said, listen, I went to the racetracks in the area of my job here in Venezuela, and something that I wanted to do. But I did it through the legal process. I did not work a single day without having my visa.
Right.
So, I mean, he granted me my work visa. But it's unfortunately in order to come, that was the only way. But again, even looking back, I did not break any law.
Right.
I did say the white lie that I wanted to come here to as a tourist, when in reality I really knew that I wanted to come to work, but the whole process, at no point I really broke the law. I did it the right way.
Well, you know, I think he saw something in you, and he probably knew in the beginning your desire and what you wanted to do, I think. Otherwise,
I don't know, but let me tell you, crazy. That guy, there was business card, and I grabbed a business card. I still have the business card. And obviously, the phone number and the email is obsolete. We're talking about 30 years ago, 32 years ago now. And I looked for him.
Do a search?
Yeah, the search, but I forgot the word that I'm looking for. I was stalking him on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that I found him and sent a friend request, but have never been accepted. I would love to have a conversation with the guy now and
sure.
Say, listen, I was here, I have been a lawful citizen, I have paid a lot of money in taxes, and I have done everything correct. So, yeah.
No, that's great. I hate that word stalking, too, because you're just looking. You know what I mean? It's not like you're going to follow them at their house or anything.
True.
But, yeah, I call it searching. I don't call it stalking, you know, because I do a lot of searching. So, crazy. So from there, when you got here, you got a job, and where did you start out in the U.S.?
So I started in Florida. I was in the Miami area, Aurora, Calder, Hialeah back then, when there was Hialeah. Actually, Calder doesn't exist anymore. That's scary.
Right.
And Gulfstream Park. So yeah, my very first ride and then my first win was in Hialeah, beautiful racetrack. And it was with this agent. And then after a little while, he told me that he had another jockey and that he was better. And so he let me go. And I ended up picking up another agent who was amazing, helped me a lot. But likewise, I got to a point where I lost my apprenticeship, and now it's a really big change because you don't have the benefit of the trainers when they acquire your services. Instead of the horse running with 120 pounds, initially they can it can be 10 pounds less, and then 7 pounds, and then eventually 5 pounds, depending on how many races you have won. But that's the incentive because you are the horses are running lighter with you as an apprentice. But when you don't have that benefit anymore because you became a professional, then you have to go head-to-head with the Angel Cordero. So in my case, it was with John Velasquez. So I was, and you, when you start as a professional, you are somewhat in a disadvantage. So this new agent that I had also, I got to a point where we were going to Gulfstream Park for the first time. And he told me that he had talked to another agent at another lesser track for me to go during that meet. And I thought about it and I say, gosh, I have a few dollars saved. I say, I want to stay here and give it a try. And he's like trying to convince me, it's going to be too tough. And I stay at Gulfstream and I did so well. I was so insanely obsessed with working hard and improving my mounts. And I ended up winning 17 races, which was a big deal. And so then after a couple of years, I also ended up working with another agent for a couple of years. And eventually, I was fortunate enough to Edgar Prado, the amazing Hall of Fame jockey Edgar Prado, and his agent Steve Rushing parted ways because Edgar wanted to come to New York and Steve Rushing wanted to stay in Maryland because he was starting a new family. And he asked me to take my book and I said yes. And he was my agent the last 13 years I rode. And the trajectory of my profession would not have looked the same if it wasn't for him. He was incredible. He's like my brother, but the best in this game, and his relationship with the trainers in how he managed a difficult situation sometimes when you have many mounts to choose from. And,
sure.
Yes, and he's the best. And after my retirement, he ended up taking two jockeys. I don't know if you have heard of them, Ira Ortiz and Jose Ortiz.
Oh, my God.
Exactly.
Really?
So,
really?
Yeah, and they are doing so well.
Oh, they're amazing. They're amazing.
Yeah.
Probably some of the name is the tops in the nation, I think. I mean,
definitely.
They race all the big races. And because I know there's a couple big races during the Saratoga meet, and they're always gone.
They're all in all of the big races throughout the country, and they're really the first choice from most trainers. They say, this is the guy that I want to ride my horse. They're amazing.
Yeah, and they're neat guys, too.
Super nice guys.
I like the two of them. They come up once in a while in the clubhouse, talk to some owners and some people they know, and they always stop by and say hello. You know, that's
nice.
Kind of neat. But so God's blessed you during your career in coming here, and you know, you've had just a wonderful life.
Oh, incredible, incredible. That is absolutely right, the right word. I have been blessed my whole life, and when I think about my career, it has been incredible. From the difficult times when things perhaps are not going right and you kind of start questioning what direction the career is going, and before I knew it, something magical was being orchestrated by God, and sure enough, here a new door will open, and it was incredible. And not to mention how much I enjoy the profession. So to do something so well, or do so well in something that I love so much, it was incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, for such a traumatic injury, you came out of it really good.
Knock on wood, amazing. Thank God, yes.
I just want to take a little station break here. You're listening to WSPN 91.1 FM Skidmore Radio. If you want to give a call, 518-580-5783. I'm your host, Rick Thompson, and we're here with Ramon Dominguez, who I consider one of the best jockeys ever. And he probably would give me an argument about that. But I know you would. But to me, he is. And he's a great guy. Hey, I want to talk about for a minute the... people always think jockeys are abusing horses as they're coming down the stretch to get them to either stay focused during the race or to spur them on. They think they're whipping them to death. You came up with a product Well, talk a little bit about that. I know it's called the crap.
Sure.
But talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I would say you're absolutely right. The optics are awful. And in reality, we are hitting a horse with this device or this tool. So the truth is that there has been an evolution, a positive evolution, to protect the horse over the last, I want to say, maybe it was 2004 when they introduced a new, I call it riding crop. It's a little more pleasing to the ear than the whip. But a new riding crop was introduced where the area of contact with the horse, it was padded to some degree, mm-hmm. and therefore the impact was diminished. And so I was at the time riding at Delaware Park, and I saw it, and I felt like this was an amazing change. At the same time, it is this area that is basically covering the rod that the jockey will hold in his hand.
Right.
It was made by two pieces of material that are sewn around the edges, and that stitching creates an edge that, if you don't have contact with the flat part and just with the edge, it can definitely increase the pain and in some cases actually harm the horse. So that kind of stuck with me, and I was thinking, how do I minimize these edges? And again, I was just an active jockey at the time, and I came up with the idea that if it was a cylinder doesn't have edges. So with that in mind, I remember going to Walmart, and I bought an inner tube for a bike, and I filled it in with a piping insulation that they use in the states where there is winter month to insulate the piping. And so that was my first prototype, and I liked it enough that I ended up going and filing a patent for it that I got. And I was busy at the time on my career, and I kind of put that aside. And then the time came when I retired, and I connected actually with a friend who we finished high school together.
Really?
In the same school in Venezuela.
Oh, my God.
And his uncle was a very, very successful jockey in Venezuela. Jesus Marquez was his uncle. And my friend is Carlos Marquez. He also pursued a career as a jockey. And he rode in Venezuela, and then he came to the United States, and he was up until no long ago riding in Louisiana. And since he was in Venezuela, had this desire to really mess with the crops and make them. And he has been making them for a while, and he makes amazing, amazing. His craftsmanship is incredible. So I talked to him. I said, listen, I don't know anything about making crops, but I had this idea. And we became partners, and we have been making them for since 2018.
Okay.
And now we are positioning. We have a manufacturing team that is helping us to be able to scale this and position this in other equestrian disciplines who are liking it a lot too, like show jumping and eventing and those. So, okay, I talked about the idea and how I came into it, but I want to go back and answer another part which is important, which is the why we are hitting the horses with these crops. So, when the horse runs, they sometimes have a mind of their own. Some horses are really eager to run, and if that's the case, wonderful. Your job as a jockey is to control their speed, because ultimately, at the end of the day, everyone, the goal that you have is to save enough energy to have the last part of the race, the horse run
sure.
fast and win the race.
Like a runner.
That's it, like a runner.
You
yes.
want to save energy.
That's it. So if the horse is, again, a horse that is eager to run early on, you just control the speed, and the last part of the race, in some cases, I didn't have to really even move my hands. I just kind of encouraged them by making sound with my mouth, and the horses would give me a good finish, and I would win the race. Wonderful. Amazing if they all were like that, but they are not. Some of them are so talented, and they are, like, lazy, and they're like, I will do just as little as I have to do. So with those horses, to make it fair and for them to have a chance to perform their best and to win, when the last part of the race comes and you have to start moving your hands in their neck and kind of encouraging them, as we call hand riding, but also sometimes they are big animals and you need to encourage them, and there is, and by reaching back and hitting them in their hindquarters. And this makes sound, and that is one of the best ways to encourage them, because that sound, upon making contact with their hindquarters, they are like, okay, I have to run. And there are theories that suggest that this all goes back to actually many, many centuries ago were horses in the wild being followed, being chased by whether it was tigers or lions, I don't know, when they were able to catch and they will basically put their claws in their behind ends and the horses will try to run away from that, obviously, okay. to save their lives. So therefore, subconsciously, again, this is a theory that when they feel this impact in their hindquarters, it's like, okay,
they have to get out of it.
Yes, I have to get out of it. So whether that's true or not, again, the encouragement is necessary to maintaining a level playing field because every horse has a different demeanor. One last thing I want to say about the shape of this area of this riding crop, which I ended up naming 360 GT, and my wife came up with the idea because 360 is a cylinder, it's 360,
round degrees, yeah.
And GT stands for gentle touch.
Okay.
And nowadays it's made out of a soft foam that the shock absorption is amazing. It's kind of like the flip-flops when you go to the beach that if your mom ever hit you with one of those, makes a lot of noise, and but in reality,
hurt.
It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
So that's basically what we were able to achieve, that it makes noise, which is a great source of encouragement, but at the same time, it's really no harm in the animal.
Right. Well, you got to have, I mean, like you said, horses have their own minds, and sometimes they need to refocus on the race, especially if you got horses coming up on the side or that, you got to make sure that they get that extra kick, you know.
Great point, Rick. And another angle or aspect of when it comes to the safety, because we have talked solely about the encouragement and for the horse to perform their best, but the angle of safety is, it's a joke. You are so in tune with what your horse is doing, their behavior, their body language, that oftentimes, especially young horses, we'll get into the race and maybe if it was raining, there is a puddle of water and they are kind of looking at it from the distance and they want to kind of spook from it.
Yeah.
Or sometimes they are also shying away from other horses, or there is an opening, like you said, that horses on both sides, and you know that you have enough horse under you to really go through that opening, but they are uncertain because it seems a little tight. So just by tapping them on the shoulder with this crop, and you kind of assuring it is okay, and they kind of get brave and go through it. And
sure.
So that's important, is increasing the safety of the race.
And I would assume, too, it depends on the age of the horse. The more experience a horse has in racing, the more use he gets to having horses on each side and stuff.
Absolutely.
One of the things, another thing that I see jockeys do, which goes to your, you know, awesomeness, is you have to change hands sometimes with that crop.
Yes.
And that, controlling the animal, making sure he's staying on course, thinking of your next move, having to change hands with the crop to slap the other flank is awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's one of those where there are so many different things that you're doing on top of a horse, but as you are encouraging the horse, let's say that you're using your riding crop with the right hand, and then the horse gets to a point where he's like somewhat used to it, like you hit him 3-4 times, and you're not getting a lot of response, you take... In this case, if you're using it with your right hand, you have both reins on your left hand. Sometimes you're grabbing a little bit of mane for security as well. But now you have to take and bring both hands together. And this happens in a fraction of a second. It cannot take too long. And take the handle of the riding crop with your left hand while still securing with your left hand the reins. But now grabbing your reins with the right hand to be able to have your left hand loose free to be able to now hit the horse with your left hand. So yeah, that's among many things. And while you're doing that, sometimes the horse is drifting and simultaneously you have to be pulling on one of the reins to keep them straight. So
awesome.
The best way for someone to relate to this, if any of you have ever tried, whether you are an avid golfer or you even took some lessons of how to golf, it's sort of like when you kind of have the grip of the golf club, how you grab the handle.
Right.
But now, simultaneously, you have to create this motion to bring it back and forward to strike the ball. And it's so many different things that then with time you're kind of finessing and perfecting that. But you get to the point, ultimately, or hopefully, where you're not thinking about it. You just kind of swing.
It becomes and hit normal.
It. Yeah, it comes normal and natural. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, not only... not only did you have an amazing career, you're an amazing guy, but you came up with a product that seemed like it was an abuse of the horse, which really wasn't an abuse. I mean, it may have stung the horse a little bit, but you came up with a 360 GT that really used noise and soft padding to get its attention to... because they can have a mindset of their own. I mean, it's amazing. These horses
very much so, yes.
They're just like people, different people. I mean, this past year, these two horses that were going at it in the Derby and in the Breeders' Cup, they wanted to run. And yes. Like you said, sometimes you have a real fast horse, so you have to hold it back. And know when to open it up.
Yeah, and that's the dream of the jockey, to have a horse that really wants to make your job easy by being very determined and very willing to go and go forward. And as long as they listen to you also when you say, I want you to slow down a little bit. Yeah, that's especially on the grass, when you have a horse that is really wants to pull themselves forwardly and you just take a hold,
right?
Because on the grass it's so important for them to relax, to then in just a 16th of a mile they can give you a huge burst of speed that will go from last to first in
blow
some
you
cases
away.
Yeah.
You ever do a steeplechase?
I never did, however, before I became a jockey, because my parents were not too happy about the idea. They enrolled me in a show jumping school, and I did show jumping for a year, which was amazing.
Okay.
For me, it's a foundation piece.
People like steeplechaser. I don't like it. I was always positioned out on the infield by a jump. Security guard had to be positioned each way to give signals if the horse went down and jockey got up and went off. And I was always nervous when those horses
had
the jump.
I hated watching it because I'm always like you, like nervous. The reality is they fall pretty often. And in the jockey room in Saratoga, because they sometimes have a steeplechase race and we share the same room with the steeplechase riders. And it's funny because anytime that you engage in conversation with them, it's a flat jockey. They tell you that we're the crazy because we are falling at really high speeds while they're going much slower because they have to go over jumps.
Then it's a long race, too. It's
yeah,
a 2 mile.
But still, it's kind of difficult for me.
A good friend of mine who I grew up with, who moved up here, he retired as a fireman, and where we grew up, he's a fire marshal. He won't watch him.
I have a funny story to tell you. So one day I come to the paddock to ride a race, and Jonathan's Chepper, amazing, rest in peace.
Oh, yeah.
Jonathan Chepper, who is a Hall of Famer and did very well with flat, but he excelling with a steeplechase.
Yep.
And previously that day there was a steeplechase race, and perhaps I was the first race, and I was riding for him the second race. And I come to the paddock and I said to Jonathan, I said, Jonathan, I'm going to be honest, I don't like watching these races. Man, I'm like, holding my breath. And I will never forget his response. He kind of paused for a second and said, Ramon, I understand sometimes I don't like watching them either.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. They're nerve-wracking, to say the least. I mean, they're great jockeys, and usually they're bigger and
much
they weigh
bigger,
a little
yeah.
more. Yeah, but I used to be out there. I had to watch. I kind of bent my head down when they jumped, and I lifted it up quick to make sure nobody went down, But I don't know. That was crazy. All right, so you are now president of the board on the New York Racetrack Chaplaincy. Why don't you talk about what that is first?
Sure. So the New York Racetrack Chaplaincy is an organization. There are racetrack chaplaincy in a lot of the racetracks in the U.S., and this one that is in New York, it has been around for a long time. And the purpose of the goal with the chaplaincy is to serve the backstretch community. And besides bringing the word of God to the backstretch workers, also there are so many different programs, all with the goal of supporting the backstretch workers and families. Some of them, for example, when the families come to Saratoga, typically the fathers and sometimes fathers and mothers are working with the horses, with the groom, or perhaps they also have work. But then the kids come to Saratoga, and it is a big summer, long summer. So that through the chaplaincy, we can sponsor for these kids to go to a camp. They camp, and it's awesome because they look forward. They have great experiences. They do different activities near the water, or perhaps they play sports. And it's something that also is peace of mind for the parents because they know that their kids are safe and that they are doing something that is wonderful instead of being in a room looking at a device. Yeah. So, yeah, that's one of many. But in Long Island, where the main building is, this building also serves as many with many different activities. We have a women's program where they have been learning how to sew in a sewing machine. We have a backpack program. We have a Thanksgiving where we give them a turkey. And, I mean, all of this is through donations and of great supporters, which most of them come from the racing industry itself.
Sure. You know Fran Wooster?
Fran Wooster?
Yeah. Fran Wooster is her name. She's works for the backstretch workers at Saratoga.
Okay.
And our Kiwanis Club, we sponsor six families and buy them Christmas gifts for the kids. And but she works with the backstretch workers at Saratoga, I think. And she gives us the names and the ages of the kids, and then go out and buy the gifts and wrap them and. And yeah, it gives you a good feeling.
Absolutely.
Because I'll tell you what, they're hard workers, and they work from early morning until late in the day, and it's a job that they do to keep racing going, basically.
Yeah. And let me tell you, these grooms are social professional. The job that they do, a lot of them, is something that really it will require for somebody to go to college to learn. The minute stuff that is so, so important. They know these horses like their own family, and they know what it really works best for them. So it is an extremely important job, not only for the overall of the sport, but also for the horse to be able to perform their best and feel their best as well.
Hey, we've got about 3 minutes left, and I want to talk about fill that time with a podcast you're going to be launching pretty soon.
Yes. So I'm excited. I've been working on this for quite some time. And, I have a team that is helping me with the production. And I have already recorded a few interviews, some of them, the people that we mentioned, Richard Migliori, actually Ira and Jose Ortiz. But I also have an amazing runner, which is a great story from here, from this area, from Albany. So it won't be just about horse racing. It will be other stories that can inspire people. The name of the podcast is Among Champions, and it's really to feature all of the things that people have done to reach certain level of success or accomplishments. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes we look at somebody, they reach a place where we kind of put them in a pedestal and they define their success. But, they're lucky or they're skillful. But the reality is, and this is one of the reasons I became so interested in doing this podcast, because so many people that I have met, whether it's in horse racing or outside horse racing, that have accomplished something great, that we do not know their story well. And the obstacles that they overcame, the challenges, and their focus to really chase after their goals. So this is something that I know that it will be very inspiring to a lot of the listeners.
Sure. And, I mean, it's like your desire to become a jockey as a kid. That's what you knew you wanted to do. You accomplished it, had a great career, you're a great person. Where's the podcast? Where can people pick the podcast up?
It's going to be launching many different places, where Spotify, you'll find it on YouTube. I mean, we foresee this is going to be on most platforms where people can listen and watch as well.
And watch, yeah, because you're going to have a video rather than like here where just the audio.
Correct, yeah, there will be some platforms that will be audio because that's how the platform really work. Right. However, a lot of them, when possible, will have the video. And again, it's Among Champions.
Okay, Ramon's Champions. All right. Well, I'll tell you. You talk about putting people on a pedestal because of, you're on my pedestal, believe me.
Thank you, Rick.
You know how I feel about you. You're a great guy, and I'm glad you're here with us today, okay? And I want you back because I only got through half of this list, you know?
Okay.
So we'll be back, have you back.
There will
the
be
future.
A part two. Sounds
okay.
Great.
Part two, Ramon, part two. Ramon's Champions, part two.
It's Among Champions, Among.
Among
yeah,
Champions.
Yeah, Among.
Okay,
yeah, yes.
Among.
Yes.
All right, well, that we'll look for that, okay?
So, thank you for having me, Rick. This
that's
has been
okay.
Great.
Thank you.